Ruth chapter number 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he went with barley tonight in the threshing floor. Wash thyself, therefore, and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor, but make not thyself known unto the man, until he shall have done eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lieth down, that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet, and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do." And she said unto her, "All that thou sayest unto me I will do." And she went down unto the floor, and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. And she came softly, and uncovered his feet, and lay down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid, or trembled, and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, "Who art thou?" And she said, "I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread, therefore, thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." And he said, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast shown more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not rich men, but whether poor or not young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, fear not, I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of a kinsman to thee. As the Lord liveth, lie down until morning." And she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, "Let it not be known that a woman came to the floor." Also he said, "Bring the veil that thou hast upon thee, and hold it." And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley, and laid it on her, and she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "Who art thou, my daughter?" And she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, "These 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, 'Go not empty into thy mother-in-law.'" Then said she, "Sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he hath finished the thing this day." There's so many different levels to this story, so many different layers, that I want to look at. First of all, I don't want to lose sight of the big picture, the overall from beginning to end. If you remember, it's set during the days of the judges. In the days of the judges, men were unfaithful. They were treacherous to the covenant. They went whoring after other gods. They set up their golden images on every green hill. They were terrible people, covenant breakers. But God remembered his faithfulness. As we see at the very beginning, it says, in the days of the book of Judges. And there's a theme that runs through the book of Judges, or the book of Ruth, that we can't miss. If we miss this theme, we've missed the whole thing. And that's the theme of the Hebrew word called hesed. It's translated throughout the book of Ruth as kindness. But it means, if you've been to the Bible studies on Sunday night, where we see this in the book of Psalms throughout, it can be translated loyalty. It can be translated loving kindness is a very common way of translating it. Sometimes grace, although that's not a great translation. What it means is covenant faithfulness. It means loyalty to the promise. It's someone, God, of course, is the ultimate hesed. He cannot break his promise. He made a covenant with Abraham, and he will keep that covenant. And that covenant is his loyalty to the nation of Israel. When Naomi and Ruth came back, Ruth made a covenant with Naomi. "Your people will be my people, and your God my God." She also made a covenant with the people of God. When she joined with them, she embraced their God, their religion, their way of life, their laws. She became a citizen of Bethlehem. That was the covenant that she made. and we see this covenant running throughout. If a person is in covenant with God, and God is showing his covenant loyalty to that person will also be a covenant keeper. A covenant keeper is simply somebody who does according to the covenants of getting along with one another. And there's all different kinds of covenants. And I think in Reformed theology, sometimes we go way too deep and we get completely messed up with all of the strange little nuances. And we start talking about patriarchalism and covenant heads and all of this, and none of that makes any sense. All covenant means is that we have arrangements with one another. Sometimes those arrangements, if they're solemn arrangements, are ratified by vows. So marriage is a covenant. If you've ever heard somebody say something like, marriage is not a contract, it's a covenant, then they don't understand what covenants are and they don't understand what contracts are. Contracts and covenants are the same thing. A covenant is simply an arrangement. If they're very solemn arrangements, they're put on paper, they're signed, they're put down, and here's the stipulations, and if you keep those, you're a covenant keeper. If you break them, you're a covenant breaker. Now, overarching all of that, using that language of common human relationships, God has entered into covenant with his people. That covenant, you see, we traced it throughout the book of Genesis. This is really fascinating. When we get through the, I'm going to give you a hint of this. As you recall, as we went through the book of Genesis, there was a way that Genesis was divided up with the formula, these are the generations of. You remember that? And that divided up all the different sections of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 2, it says, these are the generations of the earth. Well, a generation is simply bringing something forth. What does the earth bring forth? Well, it brought forth the man and the woman. It brought forth, of course, and it talks about God bringing forth Adam and Eve from Adam from the dust of the ground and Eve from his side. And then it goes on from, this is what Adam brings forth. These are the generations of Adam. And from Adam it goes, these are the generations of Noah. And I'm not getting these all, I'm missing some, but it goes from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Jacob. And so forth, and then there's some in between. And what Moses is doing in the book of Genesis is he's tracing God's covenant faithfulness. What the earth brought forth was good, a man and a woman. All the trees of the ground, the Garden of Eden, the kingdom of God. Man broke that. That's what Adam brought forth. And so God is working on restoring that kingdom of God. But then at the end of the book of Genesis, around chapter 37... it says, these are the generations of Jacob. What did Jacob bring forth? We saw the 12 sons of Jacob and all that nightmare of the 12 sons of Jacob, but most of the story is focusing on Joseph. But then Genesis ends with all of Israel being preserved in Egypt. There's 70 of them. And Exodus starts from there. And that's the last time we read the formula. This is what Jacob brought forth. So here we have the God's covenant faithfulness being traced line by line throughout Genesis. Man broke that and entered into covenant with the devil. God has promised he's going to break that covenant with the devil by making promises to his people. He made a promise to Noah, then to Abraham, then to Isaac, then to Jacob, and we see what they brought forth. And then from Exodus all the way to the end of the book of Judges, we have this all being traced out, and look at what a mess everything has become. Was God faithful to his promise to Abraham? Of course he was. He brought them into the land of Egypt. Everybody follow me so far? This is really beautiful. But look what they did to it by the time we get to the book of Judges. Did God forget his covenant? And all of a sudden, at the end of the book of Ruth, we have a very fascinating phrase that we see for the very first time since the book of Genesis. The writer of the book of Ruth says, these are the generations of Perez. You miss that unless you've just done an overview of the Old Testament and had a pretty good memory, because you haven't seen it book after book after book after book after book. Perez was the son of Judah. So it ended in Genesis with these are the generations of Jacob. Then what happened to God's covenant faithfulness? You see mankind completely destroying it. Did God forget his covenant? And at the end of the book of Ruth, as we trace all of this, the writer of the book of Ruth wants us to step back and look beyond two people who fell in love, the bickering over land, having babies, and all of this stuff, to something far grander. And he has us do all of this by saying, these are the generations of Perez. What did Perez bring forth? God is still remembering his covenant. And that line ends up, he gives a quick genealogy, and it ends up with David. And so now we see the overall picture of the book of Ruth. God has not forgotten his loving kindness. And this is exactly what Naomi recognizes in chapter 2. In verse number 20, Naomi says, blessed be he, that is, blessed be Boaz, of the Lord, who has not left off. He hasn't cut off his kindness. Hesed. This isn't just God's being nice. This is God's covenant faithfulness. God has not forgotten us. God has not forgotten his covenant faithfulness to the living and to the dead. God has remembered his promises that he's made generation after generation after generation after generation, and he's remembered it. Even when in Naomi's life it seems so hopeless, but broader than that, in the life of Israel it seems so hopeless, but even broader than that, in the whole world, could there have been a darker time? Could there have been a darker time in the entire history of the world than this time, when the salvation of the whole world depends on one Moabite woman? How many believers were there in the world? I mean, it was down to nothing in the days of Noah. How many were there? 8 souls that were saved in the ark, and Ham was cursed. How many were there in the days of Ahab? God reserved 7,000. And here in this day, in the book of Judges, how many true believers were there? How many true believers were there? A tiny handful. But God has not forgotten his loving kindness to Israel. How dark is it when the church is doing what we see them doing at the end of the book of Judges? And you say to yourself, if this is the church, how bad is the world? Very valid question. That's total depravity. This is what we mean by total depravity. And sometimes we have a very glorified view of total depravity. You know, you sing the song, I'm only a sinner, saved by grace. That's all true. It's a very romantic view. I used to be this, and now I'm this. But read the book of Judges. That's total depravity. This is what the world is, left to their own devices. This is why, over the broader picture, we as Christians must step back and look at the whole picture as to what's going on today. What is the problem today? It isn't politics. It's not gun control. It's not lack of gun control. It's not Republican versus Democrat. It's not liberal versus conservative. It's none of that. It's that we don't know who Christ is. Period. That's it. We have forgotten and turned our back on the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and people in the church don't even know who Christ is. Say, who is Jesus Christ? We haven't taught a generation of kids who Christ is. They're being raised by parents who haven't been taught who Christ is. Jesus is some vague idea that you ask into your heart and then everything's going to be just fine. Survey after survey after survey in the church shows that the church, the conservative evangelical church in America, has no idea what we confess. In the controversy over the eternal subordination of the Son, Christian pastors, for the first time, are reading the Nicene Creed. Isn't that a shame? That's the standard definition of the Trinity for the Christian church. And pastors have been reading it for the first time, some of them. Most of them say, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. Let's all just get along. Doctrine divides. Yes, it does. Divides between sheep and goats. That's what it's for. Anyway, back to this. God, though, has not forgotten his loving kindness. And what we need in this day and age is we need to proclaim that God does not forget his promises, which is terrifying if we're not in Christ. God does not forget what he has promised to do. In the middle of all of this, when God has could justly cast the entire world into hell, God is working on something else. He's working on bringing a redeemer into the world. And God bringing a redeemer in the world, he's going to be recreating the new heavens and the new earth. That which we destroyed, that which we put into the hands of the devil, sold under the power of darkness, the prince of the power of the air, God is going to recreate. Ultimately, it will reach its final conclusion in Revelation, the very end of the book of Revelation, when we see the new Jerusalem, the new Garden of Eden, with all the images of the Garden of Eden that were imaged in the temple, and so forth. But God is bringing that about step by step. The next big step of redemption is going to be David, and then after that's going to come Christ, who of course is what everything in the Old Testament is pointing forward to, and everything in the New Testament points back to. Anyway, here, recreating the Garden of Eden, just like it was in the Garden of Eden, God created the man out of the dust of the ground and brought to him a woman out of his side. God doesn't bring the woman to Boaz out of his side, but from a far country, Moab. And God is bringing this woman to this man because he seeks a godly seed. It was the intention of God and his creation that man be fruitful and multiply and spread throughout the whole earth. That, of course, was completely corrupted. But God will redeem it, and he's going to redeem it with a woman and a man, bringing them together. Okay, so with that being said, Naomi recognizes this. Naomi is seeing everything in shadow. But what she knows, let's look at just the desperation of her. As an older woman, she's probably in her 50s by now. She's going to get to the point, if she isn't already, where she's, that was really old in those days, not these days. She's getting to the point where she's not going to be able to go out and glean in the fields. Perhaps she's there now because she didn't go with Ruth to glean in the fields. And they didn't have Social Security back then. They didn't have a retirement plan for seniors. If you didn't have kids, you were left to the kindness of strangers. Well, we see at the end of the book of Judges what the kindness of strangers was. And so without kids, you would just starve to death. And so Naomi is looking at this from this perspective. There's a couple of laws in the Old Testament that she's thinking about. The first law is, if you have a piece of land, if you got desperately poor and you had to sell that land to survive, your kinsman, the nearest kinsman, a redeemer, the word is Goel, that nearest Goel redeemer could buy that land, was obligated to buy that land if he had the means to do it. And that would keep it in the family. That was the pointing to the inheritance of the new heavens and the new earth. Very important part of the inheritance laws. That would keep that land in the family. Okay, Naomi has inherited the land of Elimelech. She's got that. But the second thing she's looking at is if you're married to a man and he dies and you have no children, the man's brother was required by law to marry you and raise up a child to your brother. That is a child that would have carry the name of the brother, that would inherit the land of the brother, and carry on the family name in the family line. That was also a requirement. Okay. Naomi is counting on these two laws. The problem is neither one of these laws really apply to her situation, as I said last week. The selling of the land, that happened, they left the land 10 years earlier. Who knows whose name the land was in? It was very complicated. The second thing is nobody had an obligation to marry Naomi because Naomi was past the age of bearing children, and nobody had the obligation to marry Ruth. Ruth was a Moabite woman. There were no brothers left to Elimelech. There were no brothers left for Mahlon and Chilion. So there was no one that really fit what Moses said. So Naomi is saying, okay, this isn't quite working. I think, and I'm going to make a very controversial statement right now, Naomi spent 10 years in the land of Moab. Ruth was a Moabite woman. There was another law that Moses had that causes us in our post-Victorian sensibilities to lose our minds and not even consider it. And here's this law. If a woman and a man were betrothed, or not, neither one of them married to someone else, and they, let's say they went on a date, and the woman got pregnant. They weren't taken out and stoned. They weren't beaten and shamed before the entire community. They didn't have to stand in front of the community and confess their sins to one another. They had to get married. The man had to pay a dowry to say that he could support her, and they had to get married. And I think the only explanation for what Naomi is doing here is, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is Ruth will get pregnant, and then they'll have to get married, and then I'll be taken care of in my old age. The reason this causes us to lose our minds is because this goes against everything that we know of as being virtuous and right and pure and holy, and the only people that God can love and the only people that love God are those that are virtuous and right and pure and holy who have never once done a stupid thing. But is that actually correct? That's not correct. What the scripture is God protects the stupid. God protects those that make really, really foolish decisions. And this is a foolish decision that Naomi has made. And the reason I know this is correct is because what Naomi says and what Ruth does, the Hebrew is full of double entendres. To go and uncover his feet. Because we have children here, I won't explain exactly what the double entendre is there. There's a definite come on involved here. There's so much double meaning in all of these words that Ruth does exactly what it says she does. She goes to where they're threshing grain, and this is under Naomi's advice. Goes to where Boaz is threshing grain. It's been a tremendous harvest. The harvest is being brought in. When the harvest is being brought in, everybody celebrates. It's a tremendous gift of God that the harvest is being brought in. At celebrations, everyone is merry. They're drinking. They're having a great time. They're dancing. They're going until late at night. But Ruth goes there, but she's got a shawl and she's covered herself so that no one knows it's her. And she waits until Boaz is tired, had a little bit too much to drink. The party goes home. The lights go down, the candles are all put out, everything is pitch black, and he goes to the threshing floor to lay on top of all the grain to sleep. Now, in that threshing floor, I explained that last week, they threw all the stalks on the threshing floor, then they would beat it with sticks, or sometimes walk over it with their feet, or with camels, or oxen, or whatever, and the grain would fall down at the bottom, then they'd throw it up in the air, and the chaff would blow away. They have finished all of that, so now what they have is stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of barley that's all getting ready to put up into bags and be stored for the winter. But somebody could break in there and steal that. So the owner of the field would usually sleep the night on top of his grain until it was put away for safekeeping. So Boaz, he's out in the middle of the field, he's all alone, he's on the threshing floor, it's dark. He's drunk. Okay, his heart is merry. He's not to the point of drunkenness. His heart is merry. He's had a little bit to drink. He's there now, passed out on top of the grain. And here comes Ruth. Ruth comes and uncovers his feet. Basically, she takes his garment off. She takes the garment off of him and she lays down right there. And it says in our King James that he was afraid. Afraid is actually the metaphorical use of that word. It's the literal word is to tremble. And sometimes you tremble in fear, and sometimes you tremble in anger, and sometimes you tremble because you're startled. I think here it's cold. Ruth had uncovered him, and so he's cold. So he shivers. And his shiver in the middle of the night, he reaches over to pull his robe back over him. And it says, "Behold, a woman!" And it's pitch black. But behold, there's a woman there. And here's what I want you to catch. In this society, in this day and age, in that culture, with everything involved with all of that, there is absolutely no reason why Boaz should have restrained himself, humanly speaking. She came onto him in the middle of the night. He was drunk. It wasn't that big of a deal. He could have just married her. Except that it was a sin against God. Look at Boaz's character. He was a mighty man of valor. And even though Ruth, with Naomi's advice, did everything wrong, Boaz protected her honor and took care of her. You see how beautiful that is? Can we see how far short mankind normally comes just from that example? Like, you young ladies, this is the kind of man you want to look for. Is this a man that will protect your honor? Now, that being said, there is one other thing I want to add before we move on here. a culture of patriarchalism where this was really pushed by that guy that wrote the book I Kissed Dating Goodbye, the book I'm talking about? Joshua Harris. You know, he was 21 years old when he wrote that book. He decided when he was 30 that he had absolutely no idea what he was doing and he was going to go to seminary. So I'm glad he did that. And now he's starting to take in the testimonies of all the people that have been tremendously damaged by that book. But under that way of thinking, there's no dating, there's no romance, no touching, and there was a huge culture of we had to chaperone our dates everywhere they went. So if you have a young daughter who's dating a young man, are you going to go and chaperone them everywhere they go to make sure that they don't get into trouble? And this culture is huge in Reform circles. I don't do it because I believe in the power of the Holy Spirit. If a young man comes to me and says, do I have permission to date your daughter? When I answer yes to that question, I'm answering yes because I believe that this man is a man of honor. And if this man's a man of honor, he doesn't need me to tag along after him. And if they make a mistake, we'll hope they repent, and I'll rebuke them, and I'll follow the steps of Matthew 18 and everything else involved with that. But holiness doesn't come by monitoring every step that somebody does. And that's a long subject, and I don't even know why I started that one. But look at Boaz's character. This is the kind of man you want for your daughters. He is not going to damage Ruth in any way, not even her reputation. He is going to uphold her reputation, he's going to protect her, he's going to provide for her, and he's going to care for her, and he is also going to say, no, this isn't going to happen. And he then swings it back to the law. So this is, now, this is the way Ruth is thinking. Ruth is following Naomi's advice. Naomi was the one mainly to blame here, and this was out of desperation. How else is she going to get somebody to marry a Moabite woman? And she's got to do that, or she's going to starve in her old age. I think there's a lot of good mixed in with a lot of foolishness. A lot of just stupid decisions all happening at once. But Ruth, remember, she's a young woman. She hasn't been brought up in the covenant. She hasn't been brought up around Christian people. She says, okay, this is apparently what we do. Okay, so she goes, but she doesn't say to Boaz, she doesn't say, hey, you know, here I am, take me. It's not that. She says, spread your skirt over your handmaiden. Now, this, in order to understand this, we've got to understand the Hebrew word skirt. It means the corner of the robe. It actually also means wings. Literally, the birds would flap their robes in the Hebrew. It's the word that's used in chapter 2 when Boaz comes to Ruth, and Ruth would have remembered this. Boaz said, may you be blessed by God under whose wings you've come for refuge. You see that? When she came to Israel, she came under the robe, under the skirt of Jehovah. And now she says to Boaz, cover me with your wings. In other words, she is proposing marriage to him. Now, notice what he does. He doesn't rebuke her. He doesn't yell at her for being a hussy and showing up in the middle of the night. And what are you doing, you tramp? She doesn't do any of that. He is astounded at her heart. Yes, her outside was foolish and needed some correction, but look at what she's actually doing. And Boaz was wise enough to understand that this is a far, far bigger picture than what is appearing at the eye. Okay, first of all, we know that when Ruth left Moab, why did she leave Moab? She left Moab because she wanted to come under the skirts of Jehovah. She wanted to be surrounded by the loving kindness of God's Hesed, God's covenant faithfulness. She wanted to be a part of that. She became a believer. And that, she also made a vow to the Lord, made a vow to the Lord's people, and a vow to Naomi. Naomi begged her to leave. She said, don't beg me to leave. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Now, when she gets to Bethlehem. She's still a relatively young, attractive woman. She could have gone out and got herself a husband. She could have got herself hitched up. She could have found herself a man. She could have done all of that. She would have been legally right to do that. But why didn't she? Because of her chesed, her covenant loyalty. She made a vow to Naomi. She wasn't going to leave Naomi. She was going to take care of Naomi. She was going to protect and watch Naomi. Boaz was not a near relative to Ruth. Boaz was a near relative to Naomi. Naomi is past the age of bearing children. Ruth is doing everything that she's doing because of her vow to Naomi. That's why Boaz is astounded. That's why he says, you could have gone after any young man you wanted to. And he says, blessed be you. Where's the words? Right there in verse number 10. Blessed be thou the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast shown more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning. That word kindness is chesed, covenant loyalty. The covenant loyalty you showed to Naomi at the beginning was pretty astounding. Everybody in the whole community is talking about it. But this, you've gone way beyond what you had at the beginning. Your loyalty to Naomi and to your vows, your loyalty to your character and to the Jehovah God of Israel is something that can only be explained supernaturally. Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter. And he says, stay here. I'll tell you what to do. Everybody in town knows you're a virtuous woman. And now we see something else very practical, very practical. At the very beginning of chapter 2, Boaz is described as a mighty man of valor. That Hebrew word is the exact same word that's used here for a virtuous woman. Boaz is described as a kind man, that is, a man of covenant loyalty. Ruth is described now as a woman of covenant loyalty. You see how God took from Adam's side a woman, and here God has found a woman who's the exact mirror image, counterpart of Boaz. A warrior as opposite to, as their kenegdo, a helpmeet in Hebrew. Somebody face to face, an exact equal. The mighty man of valor and the mighty woman of valor. The mighty man of valor who shows loving kindness. The mighty woman of valor who shows loving kindness. The Hebrew words are exactly the same. You've got your male version, you've got your female endings. Male endings, female endings, but the words are the same. And the point is this. God brings women and men together and joins them together. And that's the first thing. The second thing is you get what you're fishing for. So when you talk about that whole modesty debate, what young women should wear, you see what some young women are wearing and you're going, what are you fishing for? What kind of a man are you looking for? And men with what they're wearing, you're going, what are you fishing for? And the thing is, who do you look for in your spouse? Boaz was working, waiting. Ruth was working, waiting. God brought them together. Now, when they saw the opportunity, Ruth went to the threshing floor and proposed. And there's no hint of a scandal there. There's nothing out of the ordinary there. Maybe it was out of the ordinary, but nothing wrong there. Boaz didn't rebuke her for that. In fact, it was a mark of valor for Ruth to have done so. Because she's showing her covenant loyalty there. Not only to Naomi, but also to the people of God. So he says, remember, Naomi says, that's what you do. You go, uncover a skirt, sit there, and he'll tell you what to do. Let it go from there. And Naomi leaves things very vague. Ruth, however, doesn't leave things vague. Ruth doesn't just say, okay, here I am, what do you want to do with me? She says, marry me, cover me with your skirt. Because you are a near kinsman. Now, being a near kinsman, Boaz knows what she's asking for. This is more, like I said last week, you can't really make this a romance story. And yet you can't discount any romance. Romance and love and attraction is also a gift of God. But this is more than that. Ruth is proposing to Boaz to protect Elimelech's line, knowing that any child that she has will be Elimelech's heir, and therefore obligated to take care of Naomi in Naomi's old age. That's the covenant loyalty. That's what she's asking of Boaz. That's what's astounding to Boaz. And Boaz says, it's true, I'm a close redeemer and I'm willing to do that for you. But there's one closer than I, and we need to give him the opportunity first. And then, and with this I close, I got like 2 more minutes, and this is really beautiful. And then he says, okay, now you need to get up and you need to go before it's light, because I don't want anybody saying that a woman came to the threshing floor. See how he's protecting her reputation? There's no locker room talk. There's no bragging about that. He is going to show his loyalty not only in everything that he does, but his covenant loyalty to his to Ruth as well. He's not going to damage and soil her reputation in order to boost his own self-esteem. He really is a tremendous man. But there is something really funny that he does there at the very end. He says, open up your shawl. And she opens up the shawl and puts it down, and he starts shoveling grain into the shawl. He shovels a tremendous amount of grain into the shawl. It's not a little grain. It's not a medium size. It's a lot of grain. 6 measures of barley adds up to a little bit over 80 pounds. 80 pounds is a lot of grain. And then he says, now bend over. And he picks it up, and he lays it on her. He says, now take that home to your mother-in-law and don't go home empty back to her. Now, this is the first time Naomi has come into the picture. I mean, in Boaz's perspective. Ruth didn't say, well, my mother-in-law told me to do this. Boaz has this figured out. Boaz says, you know what? This sounds like something Naomi's up to. This sounds like something Naomi is scheming. And you can see the twinkle in his eye. And he says, okay, tell Naomi I got the message, and you go back and say, I'm not going to leave you empty. And to do that, he piles up 80 pounds of grain, and she hauls that huge pile of grain all the way back to where Naomi is and plunks on the ground. Says this, and Naomi, stunned, looks at her, and he doesn't say, she says something really funny there. She says, who are you, my daughter? Verse number 16. She doesn't say what happened. She doesn't say, what is this? She says, who are you? It's like, I don't even know who you are. There's something special that's happened here. And I think the question is this question of wonder. There's something special. When she sees the 80 pounds of grain and how Boaz responds, first of all, she's rebuked. Okay. And the second thing is that she realizes there's something with Ruth that she's missed before. This is a woman who God is using in a very spectacular way. And Naomi has now realized that. And now she sees, and just with awe, she looks at Ruth and goes, who are you? What have I missed? There's something tremendous going on here. And that's what she recognizes. And then she says, okay, just sit, just rest, just wait. This man's not going to rest until he's taken care of what he's promised. You see that at the very end? She says in verse 18, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how this matter will fall. The man will not be in rest until he has finished the thing today. It's the very next morning when Boaz gets up that he takes care of it. And because Naomi has now realized that there's something more going on than what the eye sees, she can now tell Ruth to sit still and rest. When we realize that God's got things under control, then we can actually sit still and rest, and we don't have to keep scheming. God can take care of it. And he has his people everywhere. With that, we will close. Are there any questions?